Well, Asia's always on our minds, as it ought to be, the great engine room of the world's economy. Just up there to our north, we're really a part of it. And we've got a lot of Asian migration to Australia, predominantly from China and India. And there's quite a lot to say about that, Asian migration to Australia, what advantages it offers us and how well we're capitalising on those advantages. So joining me now again is John West. John, thanks for joining the program.
Amanda, thank you very much.
Well, Asian immigration has had an impact already on Australia, hasn't it?
It certainly has, Amanda, and of course some of our first Asian migrants were in the 19th century in the gold rushes with the Chinese, and today Asian Australians make up 12% of the population.
We had a recent star at Wimbledon with an Asian background, Nick Krios. His mother's Malaysian, and then the golfer, Jason Day. Not sure where he is ranked in the world, but apparently his mother was born in the Philippines.
Yes, it's interesting that these Asian Australians are now entering the temple of Australian society, sport.
Sport. That's a good thing, a very good thing.
Well, in terms of social integration, it is the greatest thing you can have, because sport is at the heart of what Australia's about, and the fact that they are succeeding on Australian terms, it's a great thing.
Well, it's interesting that the United States, Canada and us, the big three immigration countries, along with New Zealand and the United Kingdom, are genuinely blessed with waves of skilled migration from Asia at the moment. We're doing fairly well, aren't we?
We certainly are, and these Asians that are coming to these traditional migration countries are making a great contribution, because most of them are skilled migrants and they contribute very much to the workforce and to the society.
What can you tell us about the education and income levels of Asian migrants?
Well, on average, Asian migrants to Australia are better educated, higher skilled, and earn more than Australian natives. That is also the case in the US and also in Canada.
Gee, that's interesting, isn't it? The average income of Asian Americans is also higher than the average income of non-migrant Americans, which really sort of says, get them in here, doesn't it? They're going to earn money, they're going to do well, and the benefits of that will flow through to the rest of us.
That's true. From an economic point of view, there's no doubt that a selective migration policy that focuses on skilled migrants who fit into the workforce, it's a great thing. In America, Asian Americans earn $66,000 a year, compared with about $50,000 for America overall. The downside of this, of course, is for those countries themselves, because there is a bit of a brain drain effect.
Well, yes, but who are we? I mean, that used to often be raised with me when we would accept more people from Africa. People would say, oh, you can't do that, you know, they need these bright people. But, you know, I don't know about you, John, but I can't be the person that looks a young African in the eye who's worked hard, become a doctor, got the qualifications accepted here and say, gee, sorry, you can't stay, your country needs you. I mean, I think that's a decision for them to make. But in any event, it's a point that is raised. Now, you've had some things to say about why people choose us. Why do they choose Canada, the United States? And you rightly mentioned one of the points is higher wages, especially for skilled workers. But there are other things that make people choose us, aren't there?
Well, in all the three cases, and particularly, I think, Canada and Australia, we are open multicultural societies which welcome people from different cultures. And being younger societies than, say, old Europe, there is much more opportunity, I think, for newcomers than, say, in Europe.
So it's the chance to be regarded as an equal? Is that the point you're making?
You could say that. You have the chance to be given a fair go in Australian terms. And in a country like Australia, the chance of getting a fair go is much greater than, say, in continental Europe or even Japan, where I'm sitting right now.
Do you think, for example, we get, not necessarily Australia, would the West generally get skilled migrants, female migrants, out of Japan on the basis that they feel they'd be leaving a patriarchal society and get a fairer go in other countries?
That effect is occurring, and you were coming a little back to what you said on the African case. If you believe in freedom of choice in life, people will make free choices according to opportunity where they see it and discrimination where they experience it. And young Japanese girls are leaving Japan because they see greater opportunities in more egalitarian societies like Australia, like the US and Canada. And so Japan is losing out because of its patriarchal nature.
And apparently, you know, apart from economic opportunity, political and religious freedom play a part, as well as good conditions for raising your kids. These are sort of things we take for granted and expect to have, and we're furious if we don't have them. So it's pleasing to see people choosing us for that reason.
You're certainly true again, and in many Asian countries you, of course, have multiple religions, and of course some religions suffer from discrimination, and the more open, tolerant, accepting environment of Australia is attractive. But moreover, middle-class Asians, like middle-class Australians, like freedom, like democracy, like the rule of law, like respect, and a country like Australia offers that in a way that, say, a country like China, with its authoritarian regime, doesn't offer yet.
Yeah. There are all sorts of things that make us a good choice and make the United States, Canada a good choice. Economic opportunity, political and religious freedom, conditions for raising your kids. But there's one measure where perhaps the West doesn't come out as strongly as Asian countries. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, most certainly. That's the issue of family ties and community solidarity. Of course, in many Asian countries, the family is really the unit of society, and the family sticks together and everyone helps each other. And if you come from a village or a small town, again, the community ties are very strong and people, again, help each other out. But in a country like Australia or America, where everyone is more individualistic, those family ties and community ties are much less strong.
Well, perhaps we can learn something from that, and we might be even better competitors for the most skilled migrants from Asia if we lift our game in that respect. But I'm not, frankly, holding out high hopes. Can I ask you about economic stability? There have been a number of articles about the flight of capital from China with its tremendous economic development, concerns about dirty money leaving and clean money leaving, because every country wants their capital to stay and invest in their own country. But we want it here. So that's, in that sense, a good thing. But if capital takes flight, is that a sign that there's a risk of deep insecurity in China?
Most certainly. Many people really are worried about the future of China, the future of social and political stability there. And this is one factor driving this middle class and higher class migration out of China and the migration of capital. People are worried, so they're moving out. And another factor is the internal political situation, which can be a little bit arbitrary and where the rule of law doesn't really exist. And so if you're a high flyer or important person, you don't know when the system's going to turn against you. So a good insurance policy is to get some of your money out and get maybe your family out of the country as an insurance policy against such possible discrimination. The Chinese, in fact, have a term for this. They call them naked officials, officials who are still there in China but have got their money and family out of the country.
Mm. It's hard to contemplate policy we could develop that would actually work to make sure that there's not an unintended discrimination against Asian migrants here, that employers don't unfairly choose people who've lived here longer. I mean, it's a reasonable point for an employer to say, look, this person's only been here 4 years, they don't know Australia as well as the next person, and I want someone who knows Australia well to fit into my company, and so on. But in doing so, they might be turning their back on the best and brightest available from Asia to really boost their company along. But I can't immediately think of what governments can do to help business recognise this tremendous opportunity sitting there for them.
The white paper brought out by the previous government focused on the idea of developing Australia's Asian literacy, improving Australians' consciousness of the Asianisation of the world and perhaps the Asianisation of Australia. I think that at the level of the government, we need to educate the community about this Asian century, help them understand what's going on in the world, and perhaps take a more positive view, see greater opportunity in this Asian century. And so I think consciousness raising of that nature could be helpful.
I agree in principle. I'm just not sure in practice how we go about that. The fact that some people can, like me, say a couple of phrases in Mandarin, I'm not sure that makes sure that the guy with a Master of Information Technology and a Bachelor of Engineering will get the next job, but perhaps they should. But look, I've been asking predominantly about China, and that's a mistake, because Indian migration has been very important to Australia too, hasn't it?
Yes, certainly in recent years, Indian migration has been the fastest growing. It's a different type of migration from Chinese migration in the sense that it's higher qualified. Many people have IT skills. Secondly, there's not the same language problem that may exist with Chinese migrants. Mm-hmm. For example, many Chinese students come here to study English, whereas very few Indians do that.
Because many Indians would already speak English.
Well, precisely. So the whole issue of economic and social integration is much easier one for the Indian migrants.
I hadn't realised just how early the first wave of Indian migration to Australia was.
Well, the Indian migrants, in fact, came at the very beginning. There's even theories that there may have been Indians in the first fleets, and of course India was part of the British Empire. So in all the boats travelling around the British Empire, there were invariably Indians aboard. And quite a few Indians came in the 19th century working in the sugar canes and Woolgoolga up in northern New South Wales, an Indian town in many ways.
Yeah, it's got the first Sikh temple.
Yes, exactly.
Have you been there?
Woolgoolga, in fact, is the town of, and I haven't been there, but it's the town of Jack Thompson, the Australian actor.
Oh, okay.
And he organises an annual curry fest there, so it is actually a town of some interest, perhaps. Mm. So maybe you should go up there when Jack holds his annual curry fest.
All right, the annual curry fest at Woolgoolga, we better head off there. But now, of course, there's tremendous Indian migration to Australia, isn't there? And that's good for us. It presents tremendous opportunities.
It does present opportunities because, firstly, these people bring skills, they bring positive benefits to the economy and society, but they also help link us to the Indian economy through trade and investment. And now that we have a new government in India, led by Mr. Modi, the potential for the Indian economy to take off again is enormous. Australia should certainly, try and get on this Indian wave and diversify ourselves away from this China obsession that Australian business has had for a long while.
Yeah, I'm told there are more millionaires in India than there are people in Australia.
That is probably true. I don't have the figure off the top of my head, but India has a very, very wealthy elite population and highly educated elite. And it's a very strong country, and even though it has its problems, it's a country that actually is moving. And I was there in February and went to a couple of conferences and observed the country at close hand. And I think the democracy that you have in India there is a very strong factor in its favour over the longer term when compared with China.
Indeed. Now, we're not taking, according to you, and I don't disagree, the maximum advantage of our Asian migration, and you say that Canada isn't as well. Do you think, when you get back from your travels, we could have another conversation about Australia, Canada, the United States, and some sort of comparisons about the Asian migrants in each country and who's leading the charge, if you like, in maximising the benefit to the host nation?
I'd be delighted to, and I think there's much to be learned by comparing the experiences of the three countries. And in fact, one thing that may surprise many Australians is that Canada looks up to Australia as a model of how to deal with Asia. They looked up to Australia's white paper on the Asian century. And so I think there's much for us to be proud of, but there's also much for us to learn from the experiences of Canada and the US.
John, thanks for joining us again, and we look forward to talking again soon.
Okay, thanks very much, Amanda.
John West is the Executive Director of the Asian Century Institute. You're on RN, you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. Now, when we were speaking about China, John mentioned naked officials. That is, people who may still be in China, but their families and money have left the country. Some of them come here, and to get here, they need a visa, an SIV visa, a significant investor visa. So how do they work, and how good are they really for this country?